Unfortunately, at the last citywide, the recording didn't come out very well, and so I've opted instead to re-record this here at home and upload it. Obviously, loses some of the dynamic of being in a larger crowd, but I think the recording will serve us better in this way, so we'll do our best anyway. Have you ever encountered anybody doing any type of a symbolic act, you know, tying themselves up in the civic square, for example, to demonstrate the plight of their people or raise awareness to the plight of their people? Oftentimes people do things like hunger strikes, where they stop eating food, again, for a similar reason, in order to alert people's attention to a famine in a particular area or something to that effect. Well, what surprises people often was that Jesus' ministry, just like all the prophets that had preceded him, was filled with all sorts of symbolic acts. We often miss this when we read through the Gospels. We read them very flat without an understanding of that. But many of the things Jesus is doing are actually these symbolic acts, these acts that he's performing in order to reveal deeper meanings, in order to point to something that's deeper, like a famine in another area or something like that. So when he tears down the temple, he's announcing to people and alerting people to this idea that I'm tearing a part this temple as a symbol that unless you, Israel, repent, this is what's going to happen to your beloved temple. When he gathers the 12, again, he's announcing something deeper than just picking 12 people. He's saying, hey, look, I'm reforming, I'm reshaping Israel, I'm reshaping the people of God, except it's being reshaped around me. When he sits down and eats with sinners, he's announcing that God's table is open to everyone. Yes, to the teachers of the law and to the religious, but it's even open to the sinners. All of these things that Jesus does are pointing to simple or something deeper. You know, what's interesting is that his main symbolic acts are the miraculous deeds that he performs, the exorcisms and the healings and these kind of things. We read them like they're just kind of neat acts that Jesus performs. Oh, look, he's calming the waves or something like that. But rather, we need to dig into them and realize that in these things, Jesus is seeking to reveal deeper truths about himself. N.T. Wright, one of my favorite authors, he refers to these miraculous deeds like acted parables. That is, that there's stories that Jesus is acting out that are seeking to reveal something deeper about himself. Well, today, in our passage, beginning in Mark chapter 4, verse 35, the end of Mark, and then right through to chapter 5, we encounter four miracles that Jesus performs. They're symbolic acts, again. Two of them involve water, and two of them involve women. And in this teaching here, we're going to look at the first two of these miracles, and then I'm going to podcast again about the second two of these miracles. The two that we're looking at today are Jesus engaging around water. Now, before we read the passages themselves, there's a couple of things that we need to see. First of all, we need to understand that chapters 2 right through to the end of chapter 5 are actually one long continuous story in the gospel. In Mark chapter 4 verse 35, where the miracles begin today, it records on the same day. That's how it starts out. And what Mark is doing here in an ancient way is he's creating a literary bridge. What he's saying is that these events that we're about to read now are connected to all of the things that have happened before. And so we ask the question, well, what happened before? Well, remember in chapters 2 and 3, Jesus gets in these six fights with the teachers of the law, with the Pharisees, until finally by the end, the Pharisees are accusing Jesus as being one that's on the team of Satan, that he's in league with Beelzebub. In response then, in chapter 4, as we saw at the last citywide, Jesus then begins to teach in parables. And the parables, as we saw, were also these words of judgment against the teachers of the law for their rejection against him. And now we come to chapters 4 to 5, where we encounter these four miracles. First four parables, and now we come to these four miracles. And so the question we need to ask ourselves when we're reading this is, how are these miracles related to all that's gone before, particularly related to these six fights that precipitated then Jesus beginning to talk in parables? How are these miracles related to the Pharisees and the teachers of the law accusing Jesus as being one in league with Beelzebub? And I'll give you this little tiny hinter at the start that really these miracles now are all about Jesus answering the critics. They've had their say. They've announced everybody, and you can imagine the weight, the authority that these men would have carried, dressed up in their regal religious vestments and all that kind of stuff, living in this theocratic society. They would have had so much authority, and they now announce to the people, to the peasants who are illiterate and unknowing and all the rest of them, they announce to them, this one is in league with Beelzebub. He's on Satan's side. You can imagine the weight that those words would have had. Well, Jesus now, in these miracles, is going to go about answering his critics and identifying who he really is if they had eyes to see. Now, the second thing that we need to again remind ourselves of is that Jesus is someone that we really can't fully understand without the Old Testament. Now, that's so important. I highlight this so often. But what we see in the scriptures is that Jesus is actually the climax of Israel's long story, that story that's recorded throughout the pages of this, of the first two-thirds of the Bible that we call the Old Testament. And so to understand him, like any climax of any story, to understand him, we need to understand all of the story that has gone on before him. All of the rest of that story makes sense of the climax. That just is good reading sense, right? So what we need to understand here in today's passage is that these four miracles are very closely rooted and linked to the book of Isaiah, and particularly to Isaiah chapter 63 through to 65. There are all of these tendrils, these links that reach from our passage back to the book of Isaiah. And so we ask the question, well, what's happening in Isaiah, and particularly what's happening in Isaiah 63 and 65? Well, remember Isaiah's story. A little recap. Isaiah takes place about 750 years before the time of Jesus, and it really has a two-part story. On the one hand, Isaiah is railing against the people of Israel for their rejection of God, for their turning away, for their turning into evil and into evil deeds. And he's announcing to his own beloved people that unless they repented and turned away from their evil deeds, that God was going to bring judgment upon him, upon them. But the other part then of Isaiah's story was that Isaiah also then tells of how God one day was going to come and deliver the people from the judgment that he would bring upon them. And he would do it like this, that God, Isaiah said, was going to one day come as a great servant, as a great king to his people. That when he came, he was going to overthrow Israel's and creation's enemies. That he was going to then gather the people of God back to himself and back into the kingdom that he was forming in the world. And in this place, he was going to give life to shalom, this great Hebrew word, as we've seen so many times, is making right, making whole. Well, Isaiah 63 to 65, where our passage links back to, focuses on this latter time. It describes this incredible, fantastic day when God was going to come as king and deliver his people. And so a couple of things that I want to highlight that we'll see specific links into our passage today. Isaiah 63 begins in verse 11 by Isaiah recalling the Exodus, where Moses led the people of God through the Red Sea and into freedom. The Exodus, this event, was the single most significant event in Israel's collective history. And when Isaiah describes it, he describes how God delivered Israel from its enemies, how God on that day controlled the seas, how he led the people through the sea, how he drowned the enemies of God in the same sea. And you get the sentiment then, what Isaiah says is that when God comes again, he's going to do it again. He's going to have another Exodus event, except even more, even greater. Then we see in Isaiah 64, where Isaiah is describing this coming king, the coming kingdom time. He says that on that day, the mountains and the nations and the water is going to tremble at his coming when he rides into the creation. In Isaiah 65, we see Isaiah reminding the people of God how they have rejected God, how it's been like they've been spending time in tombs, dwelling in death and in unclean places. And he describes how they're eating the flesh of pigs and all of these things they need to be delivered from. And Isaiah says, and when God comes as king, that's exactly what he's going to do. He's going to deliver Israel and creation from their death. He's going to deliver Israel and creation from their unclean state. Now, there's all sorts of other links into these passages that we need to be aware of, but those links we'll save for the next teaching when we look at the following two miracles. For now, I think that's good enough. Keep the story of Isaiah in the back of your mind in those couple of passages. We'll reference it a number of times throughout this teaching. Okay, so let's read the first miracle, and then we'll dig into it from there. That day, when evening came, he, Jesus, said to his disciples, "Let us go over to the other side." Leaving the crowd behind, they took him along just as he was in the boat. There were also other boats that went with him. A furious squall came up and the waves broke over the boat so that it was nearly swamped. Jesus was in the stern, sleeping on a cushion. The disciples woke him and said to him, "Teacher, don't you care if we drown?" He got up, rebuked the wind, and said to the waves, "Quiet! Be still!" Then the wind died down, and it was completely calm. He said to his disciples, "Why are you so afraid? Do you still have no faith?" They were terrified, and they asked each other, "Who is this? Even the wind and the waves obey him." So the question we ask as we start then is, what's happening here? And we ask, is it just a neat trick that Jesus is doing, you know, calming the wind and the waves, showing his authority over nature? I mean, it's all of that for sure. He clearly is powerful over nature, but is there something more? As I said, is this more like an acted parable where Jesus is revealing something deeper on this same day, revealing something deeper about who he actually really is? Let's dig in for a second. A couple of considerations. First of all, let's think about the water. In ancient days, in Jesus' time particularly, the sea was thought of as the abyss. In other words, it was the place in people's consciousness, in people's minds, in the superstitions of the day. It was the place where the Leviathan, where the ghosts, where the demons dwelt. It was the home, in other words, of Satan. It was the home of Beelzebub and all of his buddies. What we see in the story then is that Jesus gets out onto this abyss. He gets out onto the water in this boat. And when he does so, what happens? A furious squall, it describes, suddenly comes up. Now we say, what's going on here? Well, a couple of thoughts here. Remember Isaiah 64, verse 1 to 4, when Isaiah talked about that coming day when the king would ride into creation. He said that on that day, the mountains and the nations and the water would tremble at his coming. Could it be that on this day, Jesus is using what people understood the water to be to convey something about himself? Could he be in this moment using the water to announce, guys, the day of Isaiah is now. Look at the water tremble as I ride out into the midst of it. Yeah, I know your teachers of the law have announced that I'm the one in league with the abyss, but no. Look at it, trembles even at my presence. Do we see? Do we have eyes to see and dig deeper into what's going on? Well, let's do that. Let's dig even further, deeper. If the water represents the abyss, then maybe in the story that Jesus is identifying and announcing that he now has terrified the abyss. You think about it. Every other time that Jesus encounters the satanic, the demonic realm throughout the scriptures, every time it is sent into a crazy, frothing mess. In the next story that we're going to read, that's exactly what happened. And you notice the language then, that it says that when Jesus is awoken, that he stood up and that he rebuked the wind and the waves. "Be quiet," he announced. What's interesting about that is that the exact same language is used just a couple of pages earlier in chapter 1, verse 25, when Jesus encounters the first demon in Mark's gospel in the synagogue in Capernaum. He says to that demon the exact same thing. You see, the language here is telling us something. This isn't just Jesus encountering a sea. This is Jesus using the sea and Mark recording it for us to announce that he is encountering something else. Something that needs to be rebuked, something that is evil. You need to have eyes to picture this, to see what's happening. Use your imagination. In chapter 3, verse 22, just on the same day, earlier in the day, Jesus is called Beelzebub. He's told and announced that he's the one on the team of the abyss. And now on this same day, Jesus comes to what everybody understands to be Beelzebub's home turf. He comes to the abyss, and right away, it goes furious. It goes crazy. And what does Jesus do in the midst of it going crazy? He sleeps. He's completely unfazed. And then when awoken by people that are fazed by it all, he stands up and he rebukes, "Be quiet." And he demonstrates total authority. He makes Beelzebub quake. And then demonstrates total authority. You see, he's using the people's understanding. It might not have been a correct understanding of the water being the place of the abyss, but he is using it. They all would have thought, "Oh no, the abyss, we've terrified the abyss." And Jesus stands up knowing the reality, but he stands up and he rebukes what they understand to be the abyss. And it goes calm. See, he's revealing something to them and to their understanding of himself. Well, then we come to this final question, right? At the end of the story, the disciples, it says, are terrified. And they ask then this question to one another. Who is this? Even the wind and the waves obey him. Now, based on their own story, their own long story of the people of Israel, what was the only answer to that question? God. Remember Isaiah describing the Exodus event of how God called the waters to part? It was he that sent the wind and calmed the wind. This was their greatest event, as I said earlier on, the Exodus event. They all knew it. And they all knew that on that day, it was God himself, Yahweh, that demonstrated the power over the sea. And in this story now, Jesus is doing the exact same thing. And when the disciples asked the question, "Who is this?" You know, on the one hand, they have rolling in their mind what all the teachers of the law have said. But they also have this other thing. Could it be? Could he be Yahweh? See, the point of the miracle is this: Jesus is saying to them, "This, I am not who the teachers of the law said." He is the one with total authority. That's what Jesus is announcing about him. He is the one who makes the abyss quake while he sleeps, because he is completely undaunted by the abyss. And he is the one who makes the waves tremble. And he is the one who stands and with his voice, he makes the wind and the waves obey. Could he be? Well, let's go on to the next miracle and see what's happened there. Again, a story of water. Beginning in chapter 5, verse 1. They went across the lake to the region of the Gerasenes. When Jesus got out of the boat, a man with an evil spirit came from the tombs to meet him. The man lived in the tombs, and no one could bind him anymore, not even a chain, for he had often been chained hand and foot, but he tore the chains apart and broke the irons on his feet. No one was strong enough to subdue him. Night and day among the tombs and in the hills, he would cry out and cut himself with stones. When he saw Jesus from a distance, he ran and fell on his knees in front of him. He shouted at the top of his voice, "What do you want with me? Jesus, Son of the Most High God, swear to God that you won't torture me." For Jesus had said to him, "Come out of this man, you evil spirit." And Jesus asked him, "What is your name?" "My name is Legion," he replied, "for we are many." And he begged Jesus again and again not to send him out of the area. A large herd of pigs was feeding on the nearby hillside. The demons begged Jesus, "Send us among the pigs, allow us to go into them." And he gave them permission, and the evil spirits came out and went into the pigs. The herd, about 2,000 in number, rushed down the steep bank into the lake where they were drowned. Those tending the pigs ran off and reported this in the town and countryside, and the people went out to see what had happened. When they came to Jesus, they saw the man who had been possessed by the legion of demons sitting there, dressed and in his right mind, and they were afraid. There it is again. Those who saw him told the people what had happened to the demon-possessed man and told about the pigs as well. Then the people began to plead with Jesus to leave their region. He has just decimated their economy with the destruction of the pigs. As Jesus was getting into the boat, the man who had been demon-possessed begged to go with him. But Jesus did not let him and said, "Go home to your family and tell them how much the Lord has done for you and how he has had mercy on you." So the man went away and began to tell in the Decapolis how much Jesus had done for him. And all the people were amazed. So Mark here stresses a few things that we need to highlight. First of all, we see that he lived in the tombs. It says that three times. Really, he's emphasizing this. In other words, the man is dwelling in death. He's dwelling in the place of death, and he's dwelling in a place that was spiritually unclean. Secondly, we see that he was bound up with chains. Third, we see that he was filled with evil spirits. In fact, the spirits identify themselves as being legion, which is this Roman military term invoking an organized, powerful, mighty army in the neighborhood of somewhere around 5,000 to 6,000 soldiers. And it says in the story twice, on two occasions, that no one was strong enough to deal with this man. Nothing was strong enough to handle him or to help him. So in summary, we have this man that is filled with evil, that he's dwelling in death. He's dwelling in the unclean place, and no one is strong enough to do anything at all to help him. Well, then in the story, Jesus, after this calming the seas, he comes riding across the lake, steps up to the shore, and seeing Jesus then, this man who's filled with this demon named Legion falls on his knees, and the demon, it says, begins to plead. It says this on multiple occasions, plead again and again. He is like, what we have in this mind is like this picture of this child who is desperately afraid, standing before one with all authority. That's the picture we have in our mind. And Jesus looks back at this man, and after engaging with the demon, he casts the demon into a herd of unclean pigs, or what was understood to be unclean, and the pigs run down the hillside and into the water where they are drowned. And finally, we have this picture then of this man who's dressed, and it says that now he's begging Jesus to go with them. But he's dressed and in his right mind. And Jesus, instead of allowing him to come with him, sends him home. "You need to go home, son." And we ask the question, what's happening here? Is it just, a story of Jesus helping out a guy that's struggling, or is there something else that's going on? No, there's something else. Jesus is using this to reveal again something about himself after all that had transpired on that day. The first thing we need to understand about Jesus in this story, I think, is that Jesus is wanting us to know that he is the stronger one. In Isaiah chapter 3 verse, or excuse me, in Mark chapter 3 verse 27, Jesus calls Satan a strong man. So the Beelzebub and the Pharisees have called Jesus Satan, they've called him in league with Beelzebub, and Jesus in return says now, in identifying Satan, he refers to him as a strong man. And now in the story, what we're seeing is this kind of live action picture of what the strong man really does when he engages or enters into a person. We see a man that is enchained. We see a man that is entombed, that he's dwelling in a place of uncleanness, that he's dwelling in a place of death. He's been moved into this place of death. He's been removed from his home, from his life, from his family, and all day and all night he is crying out. Presumably he's crying out for help. Now, when you think about that, even in your own world that's around you, when you see people that are ensnared in addiction, when you see people that are ensnared in obviously evil things, don't you see the exact thing happening to them? That slowly they are being chained and moved away from life, being moved further into a place of death, being moved further into a place of uncleanness. I mean, even when you see Satan at work in your own life, isn't this what happens? That he slowly is seeking to remove you from life. He's slowly seeking to remove you from relationships. He's slowly seeking to remove you from your home. This is what Satan does at work. It's one of the reasons why I find when I see people caught in addictions, how desperate that is, because that's exactly what's happening. They're being enchained and entombed and moved away from life. Well, in the miracle we have then, Jesus now is seen as the stronger man. We see what the strong man does, but we see now what Jesus does as the stronger man. And we see him binding up that strong man. You need to picture this again. We so often read the Gospels just like these flat stories, but we need to allow our imaginations to come to life so that we can really see with our mind's eye what's going on here. Jesus rides across the lake. He steps out of the boat, and suddenly this whole army of the demonic is thrown into a frothing, childlike terror, pleading again and again. It is a picture of total awesome authority. And then Jesus does exactly that. He takes authority as the stronger one over the evil that has come into this man. The other thing we need to understand is that Jesus is identifying that he has come to deliver Israel. He's come to deliver creation then from its true enemy. As the strong one, that's what he's come to do in the world. In Isaiah 65, go back to Isaiah again. Isaiah describes Israel as a people. Like they are dwelling in tombs, he says. They are unclean. And he describes how they're dwelling with the pigs and they're eating the flesh of pigs and they need to be delivered. And Isaiah promises that when God comes, that's exactly what's going to happen. Well, in the miracle, what do we have here? We have a man that is dwelling in the tombs and we have a man that is dwelling with pigs and presumably eating the flesh of the unclean pigs. In other words, he is the man Isaiah describes Israel to be. He represents Israel in the story. And what happens to this man? First of all, we see that Jesus confronts the evil army in the pigs, and he sends them away down into the abyss where they are destroyed. Just like Egypt was drowned in the sea, so now these enemies of God's people are being drowned in the sea. And then we see the man finally is called out of his death. He's called out of the tombs. He's called out of the unclean places, and he is sent home. I love this picture. The man, the closing picture we see of this man now sitting there dressed up, and he's in his right mind, and he's being sent home back into life, back into his people. It is a picture of the shalom that Isaiah spoke of. This man is being made right. He is being made whole. And he's begging, Jesus, I want to go with you now. Because he has seen the power of Jesus in his life. But Jesus says to him, no, you need to go home. You need to be with your people back in relationship again. You need to tell them what I've done. You need to experience life. The point of the miracle, again, we have an acted parable. Jesus isn't the strong man. the teachers of the law have said. He's not in league with Beelzebub. He's the stronger one. This term, stronger one, I should give credit. It's a term that Rick Watts from Regent College often uses in when teaching through Mark's gospel to describe Jesus. And I love it. This is what we have here. This man, everyone's identified him as the strong man, but Jesus now is saying, no, I am not the strong man. I am the stronger one. And as Isaiah said, Jesus now has come as the king to deliver Israel from its true enemies. And he's come to call creation out of its tomb. And he's come to call people out of their uncleanness and out of their brokenness and out of their chains and out of their addiction. All the things that we are incapable of doing on our own. Jesus has come to do that. And he's come to make us and he's come to make creation whole and dressed and delivered from death. And he's come to send us into life. Don't you love that picture of Jesus? This is Jesus. This is what the story has given us, is this picture of a God-man who has come to earth to make people whole. What are the responses of the story? First of all, two of them actually. First of all, do we see him? This is the vision of Jesus that Mark's gospel is continually giving us. Jesus is the one that causes the waves to tremble all the while he sleeps. Jesus is the one that rebukes the winds and the waves. Jesus is the one that is the stronger one. Jesus is the one that is deliverer. Jesus is the one that is calling us out from our tombs. This isn't Beelzebub. This is the one that Isaiah promised. This is his true identity. Do we see him? It's why I keep teaching through Mark's gospel with this as the one goal. I just want you to see him. I just want you to understand and see him, because my understanding when I teach isn't to give you the 10 steps to a better life. It's to give you Jesus, because I understand that in giving us collectively Jesus, when we encounter him, that the pieces of our puzzle of our life begin to fit into place, because he is the one that makes us whole. All I need to give you in my teaching to you is Jesus. That's all. Because when you see him and when we together follow him, our life begins to click into shape. The second thing then to add to that very closely then is that I really think that seeing him correctly is what makes all the difference in our life. See, in the opening story, the disciples are terrified, and they demand when the waves step up, "Teacher, don't you care about us?" Why was this their first question to him? The first question is because they didn't understand who he was. You see, they identified him as teacher. That's who they still understood him to be. He was just teacher. But when they began to get who he was, then they were filled with awe and terror, because they began to understand that they were in the presence of someone other. You see, when we come to Jesus, we also ask the same kind of questions like the disciples asked, because so often we fail to fully see Jesus. But Mark has written the gospel so that we would see him for who he is, and that so in seeing him that we would have faith. And my prayer is that our eyes would begin more and more to see Jesus. Our vision is Jesus, and that in seeing him that we would have faith. This isn't a teacher, just a teacher. This is someone other. And therefore, when we see him, there should be a holy shudder that comes through us. Just like everyone throughout the Gospels, when they encounter the power and presence of Jesus, part of them, like the disciples in the story, is terrified in awe, because they know this isn't just my neighbor. This isn't the buddy that gets me cotton candy. This is someone completely other. But on the other flip of that, when we see him, we should also take comfort that he is good. He is the one that does calm the waves. He does deliver us from the one in the abyss. He does deliver us from our graves. He does pull us out of our uncleanness. He will dress us up, and he will send us home. Shalom. And he'll do it because he is faithful.